One thing that has occupied quite a lot of time at church council meetings in recent months is the role outline, personal specification and so on for the next vicar of St. John's, who we trust will be in place later in 2020. It's a good use of time, really. It's important to make it very plain to all interested parties at the time the sort of man who the church representatives will be looking for. And one of the things our church stands for and would certainly expect a new vicar to believe in is what's known as substitutionary atonement, which will be an unfamiliar phrase to some this morning. But it's a core item, if you like, a non-negotiable element in the faith that we profess. In more everyday language, we'd say that we believe that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, bore our sins in his body on the cross, that he stood there in our place, and he absorbed in his own perfect person the righteous wrath of God that is provoked by your sin and mine. And that he made there, as the old prayer book puts it, a full, perfect, and sufficient sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. So that the way in which you and I may know God's favor today, and we may, is entirely dependent on Christ having been our substitute in that way in his death on the cross. That is a right doctrine. But though doctrine and right doctrine is very, very important, because Christianity is a rescue religion and we need to know how it is that we have been rescued, even though that is very important to remember, it is equally important to remember that we are not saved by a doctrine, but by a person. And by this person specifically, whom we meet in the pages of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John, the author of the fourth gospel, is somebody to whom truth is tremendously important. That's very plain from his opening paragraphs. But what we find in the narrative that he provides is a person, one who engages and interacts with people, his friends, his foes, and with other people whose interest happened just to be around at the time. And it's those interactions of Jesus with others that are recorded for us, for you and me, so that we may watch them and listen and learn. And what we have this morning in the passage just read to us is a especially good example of that. Just 11 verses this morning, verses 17 to 27 of chapter 19, where in the very last hours of the life of Jesus, what is it that we see as we watch, as it were, from not far away? What do we see here? First of all, we see brutality. We see the brutality of crucifixion. There is no shortage of brutality in this story. Jesus has already been flogged. That's bad enough for the entertainment of the soldiers as much as for anything else. But that's behind us now. And so we read that they took Jesus and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull. And there they crucified him with two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. He bore his own cross. He wouldn't have carried the whole thing. Rather, they would have laid the horizontal bar on his shoulders. And then on reaching the execution site, he'd have been stretched on the ground, and nails would have been hammered into his hands before the vertical piece was then attached to it and the nails driven then through his ankles or his feet. And the whole wooden edifice with Jesus on it would then have been dropped with a thud into a hole in the ground. It was extremely brutal. Tom Wright, in his little book about John's Gospel, describes a shocking photograph he saw in a newspaper once. He says a cart was being driven through the streets of a city in the Far East. On the cart were standing 15 or 20 men. Round the neck of each, hanging from a string, was a notice. And on the notice was written the particular crime they were accused of. When they reached the end of their journey, so the report said, they were taken off the cart. Two of the men were selected and were publicly beheaded. The others were taken back to prison to await the pleasure of the government. And the purpose of the notices round their necks was obvious. They were to rub in the point to the people who were watching, and there were plenty of people watching. That's what will happen to you if you get up to this sort of thing. And the sort of thing in question was actions or teachings which the government interpreted as being revolutionary. The Romans, he says, used more or less exactly the same system. That's what's going on when Pilate places a notice above Jesus' head on the cross. Sometimes condemned Roman prisoners, like the ones in the newspaper, carried the notice around their neck on the way to the place of execution so that all the more people could see and take warning. Death by crucifixion was brutal in the extreme. It was unquestionably the most dreaded death in the ancient world. It was forbidden to Roman citizens. However terrible his crime, no Roman citizen was ever allowed to be subjected to such degrading torture. Because that's what it was, a lingering death in terrible pain, usually for days on end, before expiry finally occurred. I don't know if you've seen Mel Gibson's film from 2004, The Passion of the Christ. It went on general release and has been watched by many. It had an 18 certificate. I haven't seen it myself. I don't think I could take it from what I've heard of it. It sounds to me as if it should have had about 118 certificates. But the interesting thing about the gospel record is that the gospel writers don't go down that route of dwelling on the physical gruesomeness of it all and the brutality. So when John records it, he simply says, "There they crucified him." No sensation. No blood and gore recorded, partly, I guess, because his readers at the time would know what that meant, and further comment would not have been necessary. But we need to recognize how brutal it was. Crucified men made terrible sounds as they cursed and swore, and their cries of torment would echo around the place, and sometimes soldiers would stuff rags into the mouths of crucified men just to shut them up. Now, in the Garden of Gethsemane, before his arrest, when he was deep in prayer, Jesus did cry out. He cried out, we're told, with loud cryings and tears as he prayed. Now, that was before they came to arrest him. We don't know, because we aren't told, whether he cried out from the cross. We really don't know. The others did. We know for certain that he didn't curse or swear. And we do also know that he did speak from time to time, because some of those words are recorded for us, including the words at the very end, which John makes a note of for us. But if he was silent for much of the time, it wouldn't have made it any easier for his mother watching this. She was there, John tells us, with three other women standing by the cross. And burying parent, whether your mother or your father, is a very hard thing to do. And many of us here this morning know what that means and feels like. But burying a child, even a grown one, is harder by far. And some of our number here have had to go through that as well. And he's not yet quite dead, but he soon will be. And his mother is there and watches. It is indeed a brutal scene, and it is symbolic of the depth to which human beings can descend, that they treat one another in this way. And if it was hard for Jesus' mother to watch him, it was surely hard also for him to watch her as he did. There is something peculiarly moving about his selfless care for her in his last hours as his own end approaches. He provides for her as best he can. He sees her and the young, probably his teenage disciple, nearby and says, "Woman, behold your son," and to the disciple, "Here is your mother." A little later on, no doubt, the young man takes her back to his home. Jesus entrusts her to the beloved disciple who is there. And there's lovely tenderness even here in a place of such brutality. Well, with brutality, there is also hostility. Hostility here from the powers that be. And the powers that be are of two kinds. They are religious as well as secular. Pilate, of course, represents the secular power. He has ordered the death of Jesus. And in verse 19, we read that he writes an inscription and puts it on the cross. And the inscription says, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And the chief priests don't like that very much. And they say, and I've just brought this out beautifully, the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, don't write the King of the Jews, but rather, this man said I am the King of the Jews. They don't like it at all. They've already said to him, actually, he's not our king. Caesar's the only king we recognize. So this inscription that Pilate puts up above Christ on the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, is a calculated insult. It's Pilate's little joke. He is determined to humiliate those who've humiliated him, and they don't like it. And of course, it also could have deeper implications, because if he is the King of the Jews, it could imply that they are guilty by association with this man on the cross, and they don't like that either. But Pilate just has to have his little joke. What a sad character. Where a really important issue is concerned, namely the innocence or otherwise of Jesus, he vacillates, he won't make his mind up, he won't come down on one side or the other. He's all over the place with something that really matters. But on a trivial issue, he'll put his foot down, stubborn as a mule, and says to them, what I've written, I have written. Did he stick his tongue out as he said it? He might have done. It's got that feel to it. What I've written, I've written. So push off. So there is secular hostility, of course, and Jesus wouldn't be there otherwise. But there is religious hostility as well. And the chief priests are, if anything, fundamentally more hostile than Pilate is. Because it is because of them that Jesus has been treated in this way. They've got what they want. He's out of the way at last, or so they think. He will trouble them no more. So religious and secular powers have combined in opposition to Jesus. And that is very instructive, because over the centuries since then, the powers that be have seldom been friendly to the cause of Christ. There have, of course, been exceptions to that, and our own culture has been formed to a large extent by the teachings of the Bible and the example of Jesus Christ. But these days there is a chill in the air where the gospel is concerned. And as Tim Farron found, you can't get far in politics today if you're a straightforward Bible-believing Christian. And if high office in our land was ever compatible with an uncompromised faith, it certainly isn't today. It is not welcome. And there is growing hostility as well to the gospel in the professing church, which is worse. Take Bishop Michael Curry, you may remember the name. He was the man who preached at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. He's in America, he's really sort of equivalent to the Archbishop of Canterbury over there, sort of like they call him the presiding bishop. And you may remember, if you saw the wedding or heard about it, that he caused quite a stir. He'd certainly ruffled a few royal feathers, I think, at that wedding with his rather long sermon. And his talk of love that conquers the world. It sounds so nice, doesn't it? Love that conquers the world. Well, one of the bishops under Michael Curry in America has refused to allow same-sex marriages in his diocese. In other words, he's being faithful to Christ and to the teaching of the Bible. The price that this faithful bishop has paid for his faithfulness is to be placed under discipline. Who by? None other than Michael Curry, who has placed restrictions on his ministry as a bishop in the American church. And we're going to see more of this kind of thing, more of this hostility in the next few years. It will come from religious people, even from professing Christian people, as well as the secular world. And it shouldn't surprise us. There's nothing new in that. It shouts at us, really, here from Pilate and the chief priests. So there is hostility along with brutality. What about the more down-to-earth characters in the narrative? What about the soldiers? Because they're here, too. The soldiers who nail Jesus to the cross. Well, in the soldiers, what we find is not hostility, really, so much as indifference. Just indifference. There were four of them, usually at a crucifixion, seem to have been four this time. And these four are just doing a day's work. are doing what they're paid for. They're under orders. They do what they're paid to do. So we read in verse 23, when they had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier, also his tunic. But the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, let's not tear it, but let's cast lots for it to see who's going to get it. They took his garments and divided them. You'll remember, if you were here a few weeks ago, that in the upper room with his disciples at the Last Supper, Jesus had laid aside his outer garment, and he had knelt, towel in hand, to wash his disciples' feet. But at this place, Golgotha, the place of a skull, they strip him of all his garments, his belt, his outer garment, his headgear, and his sandals, and that gives one item for each soldier, which was just a perk of the job. But there's still this fifth item, the undergarment, the inner tunic, and that they found was too well made and too precious, possibly even made by his mother, because that apparently was quite common, too precious to be torn apart. And so they cast lots for it to see which of the four will have it as his own. It's a bizarre scene, really. They are happy in a day's work to tear the naked body of Jesus, to drive nails through his skin and his flesh. They don't give it a second thought. Ah, but this piece of clothing is much too precious to treat like that. And we wonder, watching, how men can be so brutalized and their value system turned so astonishingly upside down. And yet we know that in our own day there have been worse examples by far. And we might ask, what is of more interest to people today? You see, these folk are indifferent, really, to what they do. They're far more interested in this piece of cloth than in the person who was wearing it. And today, what is of more interest to people today, clothes or Christ and his cross? On our doormat this week, more than one catalogue has arrived with pictures of very nice, fashionable clothing worn by very nice, fashionable-looking young people, for both men and women. Lovely clothing items they are. Spring is on its way. We all want to look and feel nice. Clothes, fashions, accessories. It's all around us, isn't it? But if we ask the same question, what does Jesus and his cross mean to people as spring gives way to summer? The answer is very little. More interested, really, in clothes. It's indifference. It's not really hostility. It's just indifference. Delivering the contents of one of those pink wallets to houses in our parish on Thursday evening, I met a few local people. I didn't encounter hostility as I handed over a leaflet about what's going on at Easter. I know there are a few addresses actually nearby where the vicar would certainly not be welcome, which is my fault from the past, but not many. Really not many. Much more typical, I think, was the affable retired gentleman with a Labrador, with whom I had a very pleasant chat on his doorstep. He happened to come out just as I was there. I don't go to church, he said. I said, I think I know that, actually, but it's nice to meet you anyway. And we talked some more, and it was friendly. He didn't push me down the steps, of which there were eight. We had a nice chat. Just not interested, really. I don't go to church. Indifferent, like the soldiers. And yet, here's the rub. The soldiers putting Jesus to death are not nearly as detached from what's going on as they think they are. They are far more involved than they realize. And verse 24 says, as they said, let's not tear it, but cast lots for it. This was to fulfill the scripture, which says, of these men, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. This ordinary detail of their everyday life on that day was known to God all along. That exact action of theirs had been predicted hundreds of years before by the author of the 22nd Psalm, who looked down the centuries to this very scene and said prophetically, as it were, from the cross, "They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." These men might claim neutrality. They might well say, if you ask them, they thought Jesus was probably perfectly innocent. It was all very unfair. But they're under orders, so it can't be helped. But they are less neutral than they think. They are fundamentally on the wrong side. The scripture says, "They divided my garments, for my clothing they cast lots." They, my, there are two sides and they're on the wrong one, and all of us is on one side or the other in this scene. They are far more involved with this person, this Jesus, than they know. And what was true of them is true of you and me. It's true of everyone. Every man, woman, and child is involved in this scene because, as we read elsewhere, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And it is the cross of Christ, the fact of his being unwanted, excluded, driven out and away, which is the proof of our self-imposed alienation from our Maker. It is the proof of that. When God comes into his own world, he is murdered. But at the same time, and this is the miracle which sooner or later we must understand and receive, at the very same time, by a miracle of God's providence, that very same cross of Christ opens the way back so that we may return to him. There is a way back to God from the dark paths of sin. There's a door that is open, and you may go in. At Calvary's cross is where you begin when you come as a sinner to Jesus. We cannot be indifferent in this narrative. Indifference to the things of Christ, though common, is a sad and ultimately a shameful position for anyone to be in. We ought not to live in God's world as if he were not there. And if the God who is there has given his Son for us in this way, how dare we be indifferent to what he has done? How dare we say that it's really of little concern or of interest to us? So from brutality, we move to hostility. We find a supposed indifference which is not ultimately as indifferent as it looks. And lastly, we see in these paragraphs, and what a lovely place to land, the wonderful supremacy of Jesus. Two other men, of course, were crucified with him, one on either side. Luke in his gospel tells us a bit more about them both, but we don't really know anything other than that. We don't know their names. They've faded away into history. And it's interesting fact that at about the time that Jesus was crucified and in the decades of the time, thousands of men died in this way at the hands of the Romans. There were thousands of men who were crucified. I don't know about any of them. They've all faded away into history, but this one, because he is utterly different. And he is supreme, supreme among human beings, Lord of heaven and earth. And here he is on a cross. His supremacy is foreseen in Psalm 22, from which the quotation about the clothing is taken. And remarkably, his supremacy is proclaimed here, from the cross on which he will die. And that is extraordinary, because it's none other than Pilate who proclaims it in the inscription which he, Pilate, causes to be placed above the head of Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. He means it as a joke and as an insult, but it is true. This man is king, and not just for the Jews, but for the world. And the inscription, you'll have noticed, if you notice verse 20, it was written in three languages, Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. Aramaic being the local language, Latin being the language of the empire, Greek being the common language of the ancient world. Now, even today, if you can speak English, Spanish, and Mandarin, you can probably get a hearing and make yourself understood in most parts of the world. And so then, Aramaic, Latin, and Greek addressed the whole world on its doorstep and announced to all and sundry who just cared to look that this man and no other is the king and the savior of the world. Pilate meant it as a joke, but we know that it is true. It is from the cross that the supremacy of Christ is declared to a watching world, and it is to the cross that that watching world is invited to return and there to find forgiveness and life and hope for eternity.